Immigration is never out of the news for long, and it is an even more regular story in this age of the federal government cracking down on undocumented immigrants and talking about building a wall on the border with Mexico. Who are the people who came across the border illegally for a better life in the United States? And why did they think it was okay to come across in the first place? Those questions are answered in some very personal stories in a new book by Daniel Connolly called The Book of Isaias, A Child of Hispanic Immigrants Seeks His Own America. Daniel Connolly is an award-winning journalist currently working for the Commercial Appeal newspaper in Memphis, which is also the town of his birth. Daniel has covered immigration for more than a decade now, including a stint with the Associated Press. He's fluent in Spanish and German. Daniel Connolly, pleasure to have you on the Jefferson Exchange.
Hello. Thanks for having me on, and hello from Memphis.
Hello there. So I want to make it clear, the book of Isaias, and I'm using the anglicized pronunciation of the name, it's just one Isaias. We're not multiple Isaias, right?
Correct. That's exactly right. It's the Spanish version of the name Isaiah, after the prophet.
So reporters always try to humanize stories, and it's just good reporting. Why decide to write a whole book essentially centered around one person?
Well, it all began with a conversation I had in 2010 with an old friend of mine in Memphis. His name is Mauricio Calvo, and he's head of a social services agency called Latino Memphis. And that conversation really brought to my mind the issues around children of immigrants growing up in the U.S. I've been writing about immigration for a long time, mostly focusing on adults, but the children of immigrants have some specific issues. And in that conversation, Mauricio mentioned kids dropping out of school, dealing with various problems. And he asked this question in Spanish, ¿Qué nos espera?, which means what awaits us. And so I knew that this was a project that I could do in my hometown and that it would have relevance nationally, because there's a huge number of immigrants, children of immigrants growing up in Memphis and around the country. In fact, the proportion is roughly 1 in 4 young people in America today is a child of immigrants. And so in telling the story of one person, I'm really telling the story of millions and millions of other people like him around the country.
Well, Memphis has changed a lot, obviously, over the years, even in your lifetime, and you're from there originally. The idea of there being a Latino Memphis and a Mauricio Calvo there is unusual itself in a way. I mean, how much of a Mexican influx has there been over the last few decades?
Sure, it's been very dramatic. So I actually was just looking at the statistics recently. In the early 1990s, around 1993, there were only around 200 Hispanic children enrolled in our local school system. So fast forward to the most recent school data we have, it's gone from around 200 Hispanic kids to more than 13,000. And I'm only talking about children. If you add adults, then we're talking about tens of thousands more adults as well. Primarily, these are immigrants from Mexico who have come to the South to do construction jobs. That was the big industry that drew them. And so the Hispanic population in Memphis is still small as a percentage of the population, but in terms of absolute numbers, quite large.
So which gets us to the story of the parents of Isaias from the book of Isaias. Why did Mario and Cristina Ramos leave Mexico in the first place? What was their plan?
They had two primary reasons. One was they wanted to earn money to build their house, to improve and renovate their house in Mexico. That was one thing. And then they were also interested in better education for their children. And a lot of times when I interview immigrants from Mexico, they cite economic reasons as a primary reason why they came to the U.S.
Okay, so economic reasons. But there's an excellent perspective you provide here that I don't know I've ever seen before, which is a real cultural difference. I mean, what did they think about whether crossing the border was a big deal or not, particularly coming from the political and law enforcement kind of culture they knew from Mexico?
Yes. So in one of the interviews that I did with Mario Ramos, who's the father of Isaias, the main person in my book, he said that from his perspective, you know, everybody seemed to be coming and going to the U.S., and they didn't get permission, and they went and they came back, and it seemed like no big deal. And so there's two things to know. One is that from the perspective of people living in Mexico, laws don't mean that much a lot of the time in Mexico. There's unfortunately a lot of corruption in the country. A lot of things run through personal connections. Even a simple traffic stop could result in the police officer asking a driver for a bribe. And so for that reason, the concept of law and the rule of law is just weaker in Mexico. The other thing that I think is very important is our country, the United States, in many cases doesn't take its own immigration laws that seriously. And I'm going to talk in a minute about how that's changing. But historically, it really was true that Mexican men in particular could cross the border illegally, work for a while in the U.S. and come back. And this was an accepted practice going back for decades. Over time, as border security built up, it became harder and harder for them to do that. And so they started to bring families with them. And so that led to the scenario that we've seen in places like Memphis and across the country, where there's an increasingly settled population of immigrants from Mexico who came illegally.
So from the perspective of, say, the father or maybe the grandfather of Mario Ramos, going across the border to work for a while and then coming back to the family in Mexico sounds like a fairly standard thing.
Right. In fact, Mario Ramos did that. He did that, I believe it was in the late 1990s. And then he came to the U.S. by himself, worked, and then went back. And then in 2003, he brought the entire family, his wife and two sons, with him to the U.S.
Okay, and that is the story that is told in the book of Isaias. A child of Hispanic immigrants seeks his own America. Isaias was in high school when Daniel Connolly found him and began to structure the book around him. We'll talk much more about the project, much more about the life of Isaias itself and his parents, Maria and Christina Ramos, and why they left Mexico and settled in the United States permanently, even though they don't have the documents to allow them to do that legally. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. And we'll come back and talk more about the Book of Isaias in a minute 20. You're back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about immigration today and a very personal story. Well, personal stories, really, because it's more than just the central character in the Book of Isaias. A child of Hispanic immigrants seeks his own America. Daniel Connolly, who is a longtime journalist, has covered immigration stories for 10 years plus, focused on a student in the Memphis Public Schools, where Daniel currently works and actually is from. He was born in Memphis. You can join the conversation on the exchange as we get into the micro of the Isaias story and the macro of immigration laws and how we view them generally. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So you talked about how Mario Ramos decided to bring Christina and the two sons from Mexico in 2003. What had changed that made him decide that he didn't want to keep coming back and forth across the border with the family staying in Mexico?
I think it was just a very, very long separation. He had been in the U.S. for quite a long time by himself without his family and didn't want to endure that again. And also, it was just becoming much harder for single men to cross the border illegally. There was a lot more border enforcement, a lot more, you know, barriers, guards, et cetera. And so, you know, it used to be quite easy for almost anybody to cross the border without permission. And by the early 2000s, people, you know, had to hire coyotes, which are human smugglers, to do that. And so the border crossing itself became just much, much more difficult, and that's why a lot of men began bringing their whole families to the U.S.
Now, at one time, Daniel, American law really didn't just look the other way, but encouraged people coming across the border for work. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. There's always so in the modern era, which is what I've been writing about, there's always been a political willingness to spend money on, for instance, border walls, border guards, border security generally. The area where there's been much less willingness to spend money is on interior enforcement. That is enforcement in a place like where I live, Memphis, Tennessee. And so one of the classic examples is also in the South, and I talk about this a lot. It was the late 1990s in the Vidalia onion fields in Georgia. They depended very heavily on Mexican immigrant workers, many of whom were here illegally. The immigration authorities began cracking down and arresting these workers. The other workers heard about it and fled, and then all of a sudden you had a giant onion harvest and no one to harvest it. So what happened is the business owners complained to their members of Congress, and they worked out a deal. Basically, immigration authorities said, okay, all right, everybody come back. Let's get these onions harvested. So that type of situation has happened over and over in the U.S., where the pressure from the businesses that want a low-cost, reliable labor force has pushed back against efforts to crack down on illegal immigration. So you end up with a situation where there's a public outcry about immigration. So there's enforcement at the border, walls at the border, little enforcement in the interior of the country. And so you have a situation that's like a coconut. It's hard on the outside, soft on the inside. And the question now with the Trump administration is, if they do a crackdown, how far will they go with it? Will they go so far that it really starts affecting businesses, and how will those businesses react?
The businesses seem to do a good job, though, of never really getting out in front of immigration law in any way and staying more or less invisible, even though their needs have often been met by people looking the other way on immigration law.
Yeah, I mean, so I think there's a lot of denial on the part of the businesses. I mean, for example, in my region, the South, the way a lot of the hiring of people here illegally works is through subcontractors. So, for instance, on a big building project, the main contractor can say, well, I'm not hiring anyone who's here illegally. Meanwhile, all the subcontractors are doing it. So there are these layers of plausible deniability that allow this to happen. And you see the same sort of use of subcontractors with warehouse jobs and many other industries as well. Chicken plants, for example, do the same thing.
We're talking to Daniel Connolly about his book, The Book of Isaias, A Child of Hispanic Immigrants Seeks His Own America, a micro look at the lives of some people affected by immigration because they've been part of it, and a macro look at the larger context of it. So the Isaias' father, then, Mario, had been working in the construction business. I mean, he brings the whole family over in 2003 when Isaias is 8. How did Mario and Christina end up running their own painting business?
That's an interesting story. So they were extremely entrepreneurial people, and the short version of it is that both Mario and Christina were looking for ways to work, and Mario at one point was actually a day laborer, and they got connected to a guy who did painting projects, and they started working for this person, and then they started striking out on their own and doing their own painting projects. Even though they didn't speak English, they would rely on their sons to help interpret for them. Their sons learned English very quickly. And so the other thing that I find fascinating about Mario and Christina is that when they came to the U.S., they really didn't know how to do a lot of these things. They weren't experts in painting and remodeling, but they learned a lot of it on the job, doing things like, you know, if the customer says install a fan, the fan comes with instructions, right? And those are usually in English and Spanish. And so they would just follow the instructions and do it. So they, over time, built up a lot of contacts and a lot of skills. And by the time I met them, when Isaias was in high school, they were doing pretty well in their business.
So how did you first find Isaias, and why was he the logical person to focus on for your book?
So I got permission from the school system to act as an embedded reporter inside Kingsbury High School in Memphis. This is a school that enrolls hundreds of Hispanic teenagers. And on the second day of the school year, I was introduced to Isaias by a woman who works in the school. And she told me that, you know, this is a really bright young guy and he's trying to decide his future. And so on the first meeting with him, I was struck by, first of all, how smart he is. And, you know, he told me in the first meeting that he likes to listen to Bjork and her old band, the Sugar Cubes.
Right.
For those who don't know, that's a pop singer from Iceland. And it's just kind of an unusual choice for, it struck me as an unusual interest. And there were so many other things about him. He'd gone on TV as captain of the Quiz Bowl team. And so what was compelling about him, and the reason I focused the book on him, is that here's this guy who's incredibly smart, and he's not sure what he wants to do with his life. People at school are telling him apply to college, and he's saying, well, I don't know if that's for me. Maybe I should do house painting with my family, or maybe I should go be a musician. And so I thought that he represented this human potential among the children of immigrants growing up in the U.S. And so the theme of the Book of Isaiah is the children of immigrants have great potential. Many factors threaten their potential, and we should help them develop their potential for everyone to benefit.
But, you know, here again, we get from the micro to the macro, and you get a sample from a larger set. I mean, how does Latino college attendance compare to other groups in America?
Historically, the Hispanic youth have gone to college and completed college at much lower rates than other groups. And so with the rapid growth in the Hispanic youth population, that presents a conundrum for the society, because the more education people have, the more money they earn. And so when you have more young people going to college, it means more money for Social Security, more money for Medicare, more money for governments to do various projects, and that benefits the whole society. So my thesis in the book, and actually the thesis of a lot of people who are working on this, is that we as a society should help children of immigrants prosper and go as far in their education as they can. Not everybody can or should go to college, naturally, but those who can go that far should.
I was just reminding myself of the court ruling that allowed them all to be in public school in the first place. And I didn't realize it was all the way back in 1982 in the Plyler versus Doe case, in which the Supreme Court said, well, as long as the children are going to be in this country, we shouldn't bar them from education. So they will at least get to go to public school, whether they're illegally or not.
Yes, that's right. That Supreme Court case from the early 80s opened the door for any child, whether they themselves are in the country legally or not, to attend public school and get a basic education. One thing I think is very important to point out, even though I've been talking about Isaias, who was brought, he himself was brought to this country without permission. The vast majority of young people, young Hispanic kids in America, are citizens. It's over 90% are citizens. So, for example, Isaias has a younger brother named Dustin, who was born in Memphis, Tennessee, and his birthplace makes him a citizen. So I think as we discuss the immigration debate, there's a tendency to focus on adult immigrants, and then to perhaps a lesser extent to those who we might have read about called the Dreamers, who are those who, like Isaias, you know, were brought to this country without permission. But in fact, among young Hispanics, the vast majority are citizens.
That is really good to know. So we're talking about essentially 10% of the young people are the DACA kinds of people, and the 90% are citizens.
Yeah, it's actually less than 10%.
Wow. The Book of Isaias is the work of Daniel Connolly. He's a longtime journalist working for the Commercial Appeal in Memphis. He's a Memphian by birth and has covered immigration for more than a decade now, speaks Spanish fluently, which really helped in the research into the Book of Isaias. You can join us as we talk about the story of Isaias and his family more specifically, but on a larger level, what it represents in immigration more broadly. 800-838-3760 to join us by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So back to the macro again. We talked about the fact that businesses often ended up getting caught in the lurch if there was a big immigration enforcement. And you do talk about how well-funded or not and staffed immigration enforcement was over the last 20 years or so. In the interior of the country, it doesn't sound like it was very well-staffed at all.
No. In fact, when I was working for the Associated Press in Arkansas, I interviewed one of the local immigration enforcement agents, one of the supervisors, and he told me, you know, I forget the exact number, but it was a number that was so small that it was equivalent to the number of police officers in the small town of Hope, Arkansas, which is where Bill Clinton is from. And anyway, so, you know, you've got this federal agency that has all these obligations, not just to enforce immigration law, but, you know, deal with child pornography and all kinds of other issues. And the number of agents in a whole state is less than the number of police officers in one small town in that state. And so, again, going back to what I said earlier, all of this could change. The Trump administration has called for hiring of 10,000 officers for ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And however, that hiring that many people would cost a lot of money. So we'll see if the funding for that ends up being approved.
Well, and you point out in the book, too, that the peak of Mexican immigration is behind us now. By how many years? I mean, and how much has it fallen off since that peak?
Yeah, so the Pew Hispanic Center has done research on this, and they say that the peak was around, I'd have to look at the numbers, but around 2000 or 2001. And since that time, in the recent years, since the recession, the number of Mexican immigrants and their children going back to Mexico from the U.S. is actually greater than the number of Mexican immigrants coming to the U.S. Now, we do hear a lot about people from Central America coming to the border, say from El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and that's a different wave of immigration. And though I think it's important to point out, it's in general a much smaller wave. The Mexican immigration to this country is by far the biggest group of immigrants from any country to the U.S. in the entire U.S. history. And actually, it's interesting. My book editor at St. Martin's Press challenged me on that when I wrote that in my draft, and she said, "Well, what about the Italians? What about the Irish? What about, you know, Jews from Europe?" It's overwhelmingly the Mexican immigration to this country is by far, far bigger than any of those previous waves of migration.
So, yeah, so interesting. I was going to ask you about that very question about bigger than Irish, bigger than Italians, and the answer is yes. Numerically, though, percentage-wise, is it quite as big with the Mexicans based on the population in the country at the time?
So I'd, again, have to look at it, but in the early 20th century, around, let's say, like right before World War One, the percentage of immigrants in this country reached its peak. And right now, if you include all immigrants, not just Mexican immigrants, right now the percentage of immigrants in the country is almost at that same peak. So we are near a historic percentage of immigrants in the U.S. right now.
Okay. Given, though, that, as you point out, the peak of the flow across the border from Mexico is behind us by nearly two decades, I mean, what do you make? What's your reportorial analysis of building a wall to stop the flow?
Yeah, I mean, the wall is a symbol. It's a symbol of, you know, it is basically a political symbol of toughness and being harsh on immigration. And, you know, it fits into larger white nationalist themes that Trump used during the campaign, trying to divide people against each other. And so the wall itself, I mean, I think it is a deterrent, certainly, to some immigration. But at the same time, you know, there's always ways around it. And it's in some ways politically easier to build a giant wall than it is to go into a workplace and just start arresting people and making those business owners mad. And so I think it's largely a symbolic and very expensive gesture. That's the way I see it.
A way to say nobody else is coming in. We're dealing with this. This is how we do with this. Okay. You did talk to Doris Meissner, who headed the Immigration and Naturalization Service, as it was then called, in the Clinton years. And what did she say about the official attitude, not toward the adult immigrants, but their children, like Isaias?
Yeah, I've actually interviewed her a couple of times. The last time was in 2012. And what I recall her saying was that, you know, they were focused on the question of how to deal with adults. And I asked her, you know, okay, well, what was the planning for the, the children of immigrants? And she said, essentially, if I recall correctly, that they didn't really plan that. I mean, they didn't really think through how to deal with the children of immigrants growing up in this country. And so what I've seen in my reporting on this is very consistent with that. I mean, there is no, to the best of my knowledge, you know, there's no federal agency that deals with, you know, integration of children of immigrants. I visited some entities that work in the subject in Washington, for example, the White House Initiative on Educational Excellence for Hispanics, very impressive sounding organization. But I actually met almost the entire staff, and it was just, if I recall, something like three to six people. And similarly, the think tanks that are working on this issue are very, very small. Like the private ones, there's one called Excellencia in Education. And meanwhile, again, as I said earlier, roughly one in four young people in America today is a child of immigrants. So, you know, when I'm talking about this book, when I in trying to encourage people to read it, you know, I'm trying to encourage investment in these kids, things like, you know, hiring guidance counselors who can work with them, other concrete steps like funding scholarships, for instance, the Hispanic Scholarship Fund, the Dream.us, other groups that are raising money to help them.
Much more to talk about Daniel Connolly. He's written a book about immigration called The Book of Isaias, A Child of Hispanic Immigrants Seeks His Own America. We'll come back and talk more with him about what the individual story of Isaias tells us about the larger issues of immigration. You can join us on The Exchange by phone or by email. We'll come back here in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Daniel Connolly. He's a longtime journalist who's covered immigration for more than a decade now. He currently works at the Commercial Appeal newspaper in Memphis, where he was born. He's written a book that focuses on a student who went through the public school system in Memphis after he arrived from Mexico at age 8. It is called The Book of Isaias, A Child of Hispanic Immigrants Seeks His Own America. And it's not just the story of Isaias, but his classmates as well, and a lot of people in similar circumstances trying to figure out what to do with their lives when they become adults in an America that they are not officially part of because they lack the documents. Join us on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Haven't focused as much as I'd like to on Isaias himself yet. I mean, just how bright is he by test scores and things like that?
Yeah, so he scored better on his college entrance exam, the ACT. He scored a 29, which is better than 93% of kids in the U.S. In his junior year of high school, he completed, he got a passing score on an advanced placement calculus exam, which is a college-level exam. I think I mentioned that he went on TV as captain of the Quiz Bowl team.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he was really, really bright young guy. And someone that, you know, his peers saw his potential, and his the adults around him saw his potential as well. And so a lot of people, not just me as a journalist, but a lot of people were, you know, watching Isaias in the school and wondering, you know, what choices is he going to make?
How well equipped was the school? You'd mentioned the need for guidance counselors in some schools and things like that. I just wonder how well equipped the school was to help him make that decision.
It was perhaps more equipped than you might think. They had just started a program which was called Abriendo Puertas, which is Spanish for opening doors, and they had also, which is essentially a mentoring program for kids from immigrant families. And they also had a college counselor, Patricia Henderson, who was someone that Isaias was really close to, and she helped a lot. And then she was working with an outside organization. And in addition to that, they had four guidance counselors in the school. Even so, even with all those adults and, you know, a fair amount of infrastructure, I often had the sense that the kids really needed, I guess, just a little more guidance. And if we think about what we were like as teenagers and other teenagers we know, I mean, it's one-on-one relationships that change people's lives. And so, for that reason, I always felt that there was always a need for more more mentoring and more support. And, you know, when I talk about this publicly, I encourage people to who are adults to, you know, step up and volunteer, because there's tremendous need out there for guidance for young people.
Well, I can imagine, I can remember myself, I mean, getting to the middle of my senior year of high school and just kind of starting to think about colleges and walking around the hallways going, duh, a lot, which is why I skipped a year. In the case of somebody like Isaias, though, I mean, he had the chance to get through the Obama DACA program, didn't he?
Yes. So, and for those who are not familiar with it, the program is called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, and it is... It was created in 2012 under Barack Obama, and it basically allowed young people who were brought to the country illegally to register with the government, go through a screening process, and at the end of it, if they passed, they could get a work permit and Social Security card. So during the year that I was following Isaias, he got those documents. And so it turned out that was not enough for him to get in-state tuition at Tennessee universities, unfortunately. There was a Tennessee law that prevented that. And so, you know, the DACA example is just one of the sort of policy things that I talked about in the book of Isaias that really, you know, help people understand how we got here on immigration and where we're going. So, you know, I'm telling this story about a group of young people in Memphis, but along the way, I explain all these other policy points, and at the end of it, people, you know, really get a good sense of how we got to this point on immigration.
And so what do you hear in terms of opposite sides of this? I mean, there's the side that says, hey, look, they're here. They're not going anywhere else. They've known really nowhere else. And so we might as well get them educated, get them the things they need to be successful in society. What is the other side of that argument?
Sure. So a lot of people in the U.S., I think, are offended by what they see as blatant violations of the law. And the way immigration has been done in this country is our government pretty much looked the other way for years as it relates to ongoing presence of people who are living in the U.S. illegally, right? And so I think that's deeply offensive to a lot of people. So the criticism of DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, is that, look, I mean, these kids may be innocent, but ultimately you're rewarding illegal behavior. And so, you know, I understand that argument. What I would say is ultimately this is a system that our government helped create, number one. And number two, who does it ultimately benefit to prevent young people from making the best of themselves and the best out of their lives? So, you know, that's the way I see it.
Let us take a call. We have Grumpy John on the line from Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Daniel Connolly, the author of the Book of Isaias.
Hey, thank you very much. You know, I am just distressed by the minimalist symbolic thinking in this border wall business. If you have $25,000 million bills, instead of putting the cement industry on overtime, why wouldn't you, since we have satellites that are capable of reading license plates, why wouldn't you just instigate a program of infrared sensors, satellite photographs, drones? You could financialize that for far less than a few miles of cement sitting there worthless for the rest of time. It is just impossible to believe that you couldn't monitor the border with photograph drones with infrared capabilities, fly over, shine a light on these people as they start into the desert and say, listen, we are tracking you. We're going to let you walk for 100 miles, and then we're going to pick you up and take you back to your starting place. This is the deal. You are on camera. Turn around now. And then if they don't turn around, then you send your your all-terrain vehicle or helicopter, if you must, out and say, okay, this is what we do. We meant it. Pick them up, take them across the other side of the border, drop them off. And with the money that you save by using modern, sensible means, how about developing a program to actually help the people there that Mexico would contribute to, because they're not going to pay for that wall, a mutually effective job training program that works on both sides of the border, and essentially bring back the Bracero program, except not just farm workers, we have intellectual workers brought in as well.
Okay, let's
see. There you go. What would you do with the $25,000 million bills that are going to be put into a piece of rock that is going to wreck the environment, et cetera, et cetera?
All right, thanks,
Thank
Grumpy
you.
John. So, Daniel, what would you do with the money?
What would I do with the money? Well, Grumpy John said something interesting there, and it's actually reflected in some speeches by Sonia Nazario. She's an author who wrote another book, great book on immigration called Enrique's Journey, which is about Central American kids. And one of the things that Sonia Nazario argues is that, yeah, we as a country should invest in Central America so that you don't have people fleeing Central America to come to the United States. The good news about Mexico is actually its living standards in Mexico and education levels in Mexico are going up, which is good news in the long run, because that means the Mexican people can find jobs at home, or they're more likely to be able to do that. Central America, though, has a lot more acute problems in certain respects. And so, yeah, I mean, I guess it's a good idea to invest in those countries so that the people can stay in those countries and be prosperous there.
So it sounds like the larger issue right now is that people keep thinking in terms of Mexicans, 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 and it's not just Mexico. It is other countries, and particularly more the other countries than Mexico now.
Yeah, you know, my specialty in immigration reporting has been reporting on Mexico, and so there's in many ways areas that I have, you know, fallen a bit short. But yeah, the Central America crisis, it's driven by people fleeing from crime, people fleeing from these gangs that are extorting them at every turn. And it's in certain areas of Central America, it's impossible to live a normal life. And that's what drives a lot of the current refugee issues.
All right. So back to Isaias himself, the focus of the book, who you met while he was in high school at Kingsbury High School in Memphis. I mean, he had kind of talked about, well, you know, maybe I could go to college, maybe I could go to my parents' painting business. Did he get a little more excited about at least applying for colleges in the time that you spent with him?
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, I was following him around on a lot of different things. I followed him to Middle Tennessee State University, which he really liked. He was interested in audio recording, so he really wanted to do that. And you know, I accompanied him to Rhodes College in Memphis, where he and his girlfriend, they're kind of intellectual type kids. They ran off to the library and disappeared, and they were
to the library.
Yeah, it turned out they were in the library reading books. So yeah, he did have a good time visiting colleges, and so I was involved in a lot of sort of dramatic stuff, or like witnessing a lot of dramatic stuff. There was one point where people from the school came to his house and did a big intervention at his house to try to convince him to take one more shot at going to college because they saw his potential.
Mm-hmm. I saw the video trailer for the book in which Isaias said it was a little embarrassing to be the focus of a book, but he was ultimately okay with it. And he went on tour with you, it looks like.
Yeah, well, I've done a lot of talking about around the country, but he has come to my a couple of my events in Memphis, spoke at one of my events here, and it's funny. Everybody always asks, what are you doing now? And we were just saying, read the book. But now I've kind of modified that. I want to give people a little bit more than that. So, Isaias, he does end up going to college, but then a lot of surprises ensue. And so there are a lot of twists and turns that happen that I had no way of predicting and that make it a really interesting story.
Hijinks ensue, but not necessarily hijinks. We had a conversation about 2 weeks ago with Roberto Gonzalez. I don't know if you've read his book, Lives in Limbo, where he did something similar to what you did. He followed 150 people in Los Angeles for a real long-term, longitudinal kind of study that he then reassembled back at Harvard to talk about the same kinds of things where people get to a point where, well, I can't, in some cases, some of the cases that he followed, people had to had to deal with parents getting deported and stuff like that, and you know, put money into trying to get them back into the country, et cetera. Which I don't think you quite got to with Isaias, but this is an ongoing story that we haven't heard the last of by a long shot. It seems like the idea of people who only know America as the place they live, their home, and yet still trying to convince people that they are completely of the country.
Right, and you know, we hear so much about the kids who have sort of this gray area immigration status, the deferred action. But you know, I'll just repeat this for anybody who might be tuning in just for the first time. The you know overwhelming majority of the young Hispanic kids in the U.S. are U.S. citizens. One more thing before I forget, too. Anybody who's looking up the book and wondering how to find it, the name Isaias is spelled I-S-A-I-A-S. It's like the prophet Isaiah, but with an S at the end. So it's I-S-A-I-A-S, the book of Isaiah.
That is a good point. There are two A's around the I, yes. All right. So ultimately, well, we don't want to give away the ending of the book, I guess, but Isaias seems like he's doing well enough in life.
Yeah, I actually, interestingly, I stopped by his house yesterday. And so, you know, his family's dealing with some difficulties at the moment, unrelated to immigration. But, you know, he's making the best of it. He's acting very responsibly, and he's only 22 years old now. But I told him he's more responsible at his age than I was at his age.
Is there another book in the works about immigration, given the great twist that things have taken since the election?
Perhaps there is. For right now, I'm just encouraging everybody to check out this one, The Book of Isaias.
Daniel Connolly, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of The Book of Isaias, A Child of Hispanic Immigrants Seeks His Own America. Daniel, thanks so much for joining us today on the Exchange.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Thank you.